Brett, sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Look out. It's only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a beef jerky, and I love film. As Voltaire once said, appreciation is a wonderful thing. It makes what is excellent in others belong to us as well. Like if you really love the film Hook, then it will always live inside you as your own happy thought. Oh, that's lovely, Voltaire. Every week I invite a special guest over, I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. But not this week! This week it's the, when you think about it, way ahead of schedule films of the year 2022 special part 2 with Mr. Nish Kumar. You can watch all of Shrinking on Apple TV Plus and Ted Lasso Season 3, episodes now 1 to 7 on Apple TV Plus. Watch them, love them, thank you, nice one. Good luck to you. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein where you get all the extra videos, you get secrets, you get all the stuff you don't get on this one, you get all sorts of things. Just check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. So if you are new to the podcast and you missed last week's, every year me and Nish Kumar do our films of the year. We never do them in December because we haven't seen them all and we want to make sure we do this properly. This edition is way ahead of schedule. We left last week on a massive cliffhanger. I believe the question was, what was the sexiest film of last year? Ready to find out? Oh, I bet you are. Here's part two. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 244 of Films to be Buried With. The When You Think About It Way Ahead of Schedule Films of the Year 2022 special, part two.
Why don't you start off with your sexiest film? Given that this is the question you care about the most.
Yeah. I gotta be honest, this one, and this is no disrespect to 2022, but not the sexiest year in film. I didn't have a load of options unless I'm forgetting. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't like, oh, it's a long list of sexy stuff to choose. The answer is, I think, unequivocally, Top Gun Maverick. Got me Top Gun Maverick.
Wow. I'm surprised it's taken this long to come up. Because also, Top Gun Maverick should, if we're honest, be everyone's answer to film you thought was going to be shit but was amazing. Yeah. Like, Top Gun Maverick should be so fucking shit.
It's true. Everyone's so forgotten bad. It was meant to be shit. It's brilliant.
It should be so bad. It was brilliant. I saw it in the IMAX in the Lincoln Center, in the AMC in the Lincoln Center in New York.
Oh, wow.
And it, like, I saw it with my friend and friend of the podcast, Rose Matafeo. And at one point, she turned to me and said, "This is the greatest piece of cinema of all time." I think it might have been after the volleyball scene, but she was like, "This is the greatest film of all time." Also, you know, it is just amazing how, you know, we can build whole worlds. You know, you can put an actor in a green screen room and we can build whole worlds around them. And so you don't even need the actor sometimes. You can just create a whole reality. But at the end of the day, you whack a fucking massive camera in a plane and fly it around and nothing is better. Nothing is better.
Yeah.
Like, no computer effect can be better than a massive camera in the fucking pilot seat of a jet, and then the jet is blast. Like, sometimes when the jets were blasting, I was like, I think my insides are going to rupture. Like, it was thrilling. Do we know the nation they were invading? No. Does it matter? No.
Best not to ask questions like that.
Yeah. But
let's put helmets on the bad guys so we can't see any features. Very wise. They're sort of robots, right? They're sort of robots, doesn't matter. But it's cold where they are. Does that mean that could be anywhere?
That could be anywhere. There's a lot of countries that are cold.
They're in the east, west, north, south. Okay.
And it was great. Miles Teller is a weirdly a plausible child of Meg Ryan and
a duckling.
Anthony Edwards.
Yeah.
But it was fucking great. It was, it was so much fun. So much fun.
What's your sexiest?
Talk about the sex appeal of it. Because
go on.
Tom Cruise, as he gets older, sexy is not top of my list. I think it's impressive.
I think I'm saying it's like the whole film is so slick and well put together and well made up, and it does have Jennifer Connelly, who is
in my
top five, you know, and just seeing her in anything, you're like, okay, this puts it in the list. And it's just, you know, it's like, whoa, in it, that film. What's your answer?
I mean, look, my answer is, well, my answer will lead us on to Troubling Bonus.
Okay.
Like the subcategory, Brett, please introduce it.
The subcategory to the sexiest film is Troubling Bonus, Worrying Why Done. So a film you found arousing, you weren't sure you should.
Now, Brett, you may say it was maybe not a great year for sexy movies, but I'll tell you, Troubling Bonus, our cup runneth over. 2022 was many things. But it was also the year of the troubling boner in cinema. It was the year. It was, if Titan was a year, it was 2020. It was troubling boner after trouble. I was troubled by most of my erections this year.
There's a quote.
The film that I've gone for, any of these are troubling boners. The film that I've gone for is Decision to Leave.
Okay.
Which I thought was amazing. Full stop, love it. Park Chan-wook, absolutely love it. I just thought the atmosphere of it was very sexy. I thought the vibe of it was very sexy. I thought Tang Wei was very sexy, and I felt it. I believed it completely plausible that she would be brought in for potentially murdering her husband, and the policeman investigating would go, well, first things first, holy mama. I think it's important to say that I believe that. And like, you know, with like The Handmaiden, Park Chan-wook is he makes great sexy movies. And the sort of atmosphere of eroticism.
He does make sexy films. They're all sexy.
And eroticism is a big and important part of cinema and cinematic history. And we should not be ashamed of it, right?
Thank you.
But in terms of the troubling bonus, my God, Brett, what a year. Because Decision to Leave is in of itself quite a troubling boner.
What's troubling about the boners in Decision to Leave?
Well,
I didn't feel shame.
I didn't necessarily feel shame, but, you know, Tang Wei's character sort of gets put through quite a lot and you have to see her in various states of distress. So I don't think it feels good.
Now you make me sound like...
I sailed through it. But that sort of leads me on to a true string of troubling boners. Key amongst them, and this is like sort of troubling, but like there's an Indian movie this year. Obviously, the big one that everybody's talking about is RRR.
Loved RRR.
Yeah, and also I'm not bringing this to an audience at all, because this movie that I'm about to talk about was on Mark Kermode's Films of the Year. So it's a movie that people have talked about. It's called Gangubai Kathiawadi, and it's about a sex worker, a woman who's like sold into sex work by her boyfriend, who then kind of rises up sort of through the ranks of the kind of hierarchy of that world and ends up becoming a madam and running her own brothel. And it's shot kind of like a Tarantino movie, and it feels kind of like Kill Bill, but it is also based on a true story, and this is a real woman. And listen, the second you were talking about things being sexy in the circumstance of this film, it is a disgrace. It is an immediate disgrace. Here's the problem, though. Alia Bhatt, who plays Gangubai, the main character, is she is very sexy. And there is a sequence in it where a man comes to measure her for a sari. And like, it's quite he's a young man, he's a handsome man, it's quite an intimate process. And she gives him a look and like, she's attracted to him. There's a kind of brief romantic subplot. And she gives him a look, Brett. And I thought I was going to lose consciousness. The look she gives him, and there's a point where she's like, why don't you stand closer? What are you, measuring a tree? And I was like, oh God. I was like a Victorian lady that needed to take her vapors.
Get the salts.
And again, like, I'll also just say, like, in terms of movie star performances, like, Ali Bhatt in this movie is incredible. Her character intro is spectacular. It's pure charisma. She holds the screen with complete swagger, but she looks like she could burst into tears at any point. Like, it's a sort of, it's a proper, like, movie star character actor. Denzel in Training Day. Right. Julie Roberts in Erin Brockovich. It's a proper, like, there's not a better performance on film that came out this year. But my God, she's sexy. And I didn't feel good about it. But that's not even my real answer. My real answer is Blonde. And I wish to... Blonde made me want to chop my own dick off. Because it's a film about an exploited movie star. Mm-hmm. There's constant nudity in it. I would argue there doesn't need to be as much nudity as there is in it. So we're making a movie about a woman actress exploited by a system. And we're also making an actress walk around naked the whole time. But it's also... Ana de Armas is very attractive, playing one of the most famously sexy women of all time. I don't feel good about it, Brett. I hate myself. I've never hated myself more in my life.
Yes, every year you deliver. You deliver, and no one can take that away from you. No one in the history of films to be buried with does Troubling Boners as well as you. And I respect it, and I am grateful.
What was my
answer is men. Rory Kinnear constantly giving birth to himself out of his arsehole.
Truly, Brett, you and I are the Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal of Troubling Boners. Every year, we push each other to new heights.
Oh, shit. What's the best action film of the year?
Straightforward for me, Top Gun 2. It blew my mind. It was thrilling. I loved it. For you?
I'm picking this because Top Gun obviously is Top Gun, but I'm going to give a special shout to The Woman King, which
Bang.
I loved and did loved think, it. Weirdly, again, a sort of marketing thing, Woman King was kind of presented as an important movie. Before I saw it, it felt like, this is going to be hard work, is what I assumed. I thought, this is going to be like a heavy movie. When in fact...
What is this, a fucking book?
Yeah, I was like, this is going to be another book one. It's a fucking great action film. It's incredibly well made and entertaining. And yes, it has all the deep stuff in it. Sure, of course it does. But it's also a fucking banging action film.
Yeah.
Like, really, really good, exciting, thrilling... Proper great action. Loved it. Highly recommend as an action film. Woman King.
It's really great. Also, the action is so well shot as well. Like, it's properly, like, it's good. It's really exciting.
And they're doing it. They're really doing it. There's a lot of real stunts and very exciting. Good film.
Yeah. I saw Sheila Atim in the Bob Dylan musical, jukebox musical, in the category of things that should have been awful but were actually amazing. I saw her in it, and she sings... honestly, like an angel. And when I saw her in this movie, like, bashing people over the head, I was like, Sheila Atim, I think, can literally do anything. Like, I think if you're looking for a star of George Miller's new movie about mice doing a musical in hell, I'm pretty sure she could pull that off.
What is the film you most related to this year?
The film I'm most related to this year is Everything Everywhere All at Once. And this is absolutely the thing that you were alluding towards earlier. The first time I saw it, I went with Ed Gamble, and afterwards he was like, when the mother didn't know what to say to the daughter and called her fat, I knew you were in trouble.
Oh, shit.
He was just like, I knew you were in trouble immediately. I think it's an amazing movie. It's a lot of things, but I think it's an incredible movie about immigrant parents and immigrant children and how... The expectations of immigrant parents can sometimes be a burden on their children, but also how their children can sometimes lose sight of what their parents have been through. I thought it was such an even-handed, you know, there's so many movies where immigrant parents are just one-dimensional characters who just want to spoil their kids' fun. But this, to me, it felt like a really, really nuanced portrayal of that relationship and that dynamic. And, you know, you sort of understand the pressure that Michelle Yeoh's character was under from her father, and how that kind of pressure and the sort of generational trauma of leaving your home and upending your life then creates that sense of expectation on your children, and how that gets passed along. But it also showed that you can sort of heal that relationship. And just like at the end, like when they're like getting sucked into the sort of vortex, and the daughter's being held by the mum who's being held by her dad. That film to me was so much about, again, like the weird thematic overlap between that and After Sun, this like idea of forgiving your parents for making mistakes and for just being human beings. And also just furthermore to that, you know, like I was a kid who, you know, my parents were immigrants, and the entire way that I interacted with the world as a child was through science fiction and superhero films and comedy. And so to see a film for me that was about how immigrant parents and children relate, filtered through the prism of really superb comedy and a multiverse-based plotline, I couldn't believe that anyone else understood that movie, because it felt like it was made for me. And I think that, interestingly, that you sort of highlighted the relationship between the mum and dad, which is obviously also brilliant. But I think maybe that's why that film is so successful, is that there's a lot of different people who believe that film was made specifically for them and was talking directly to them, but they might have five or six different reasons as to why that is.
Nish, have you forgiven your parents yet?
It sounds like my parents did something terrible. They really didn't.
But no, I haven't.
I don't think I really have anything, they really have anything to be forgiven for. But like, I think it's just like that act of empathy with your parents is so important. But also for parents, I think it's that empathy is a two-way street. I think that's what that film, so much of that film is about. It's about trying to understand where someone else was coming from, whether it's your partner or your child or your parent. So much of that film is about how important empathy going in both directions is. I could not have related to that film more.
Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful. My answer is just to use films that we haven't used, even though I could say Everything Everywhere, and I also could say Banshees of Inisherin, and I could say After Sun, but it would be The Worst Woman in the World.
Brett, what a Freudian slip.
No.
truly the worst woman in the world.
The worst person in the world, in which I related to the worst woman in the world.
Loved it.
Great movie.
I'm so happy. I'm so happy you mentioned it. It was a great, the worst woman in the world.
Shit.
That was the original name for the Iron Lady, wasn't it? Bang! He will do politics. You
he
can't
will not
stop him.
Be stopped. This dish is not for turning.
What was it? Because I thought it was a brilliant movie. It could have been my answer in many categories. What was it that you related to?
I think
to
it's
about it?
the sort of thing of she is kind of just, I read somewhere, so I can't take credit for this, but this line that I was like, yes, that's exactly it. It's the constant process of becoming.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm this. No, I'm this. No, yeah. I'm in love with this. I love this. I'm this. And even by the end, she's still not. She's still finding who she is, what it's all about, all of it. And I think the like, it's just very real. It feels very, very real. I think the sequence when she tries to break up with her boyfriend, and then it goes on for so long, and then they have sex and they like that. It's so real. And then the feeling of when she first meets the other guy, like all of it. It was all very, very, I thought, very, very relatable. And and this idea of like, it keeps feeling like she's got it. She's figured it out. And then it's like, no, not that.
No, and she, by the end, I mean, and they do something sort of nice, even with like her hair colour's completely changed. They make her like physically look like a different person by the end. And it is like, it's a great movie about how someone's brain evolves and how someone's personality changes, and it eventually feels quite radical, but it all feels quite subtle, like it's like a slow moving thing.
And it's also the thing of, weirdly, like, it's a kind of positive ending in which she's alone and everyone that she loved has moved on, and yet she's probably the best, you know, as in it's like it leaves her like, yeah, cool, what's next?
Yeah, yeah, what's next? You know? Yeah, it is a positive ending. Also, what a soundtrack.
What a soundtrack.
A fantastic soundtrack. That Art Garfunkel song at the end, the Nielsen song, it's all... I also tried to get people to dance in a context that's not appropriate by playing One Thing by Amory, so I also very much related to this movie. Yeah, it was a great movie. And one of those films that I was talking about that I think on some of the year-end lists, it either didn't feature or it featured quite low down, and I think it's literally just because it came out in January. It came out in January, yeah. Yeah. I think it's a brilliant film.
What was the greatest film of the year? Objectively the greatest. Tough one.
I mean, yeah, it is a real tough one. I mean, in the interest of giving one that I think probably isn't going to be my number one, I'll say Living.
Okay.
Because again, I thought it was brilliant because again, it didn't sort of think, does it need to exist? Like, Ikiru is already a movie that lots of people have watched and people love, but I thought it was brilliant. I thought Amy Lou Wood was incredible in it. And I also like, I love Bill Nighy. And I also like, I love the Bill Nighy thing that he does so often. You know, the kind of character that he plays in, like, sort of versions of this sort of swaggeringly charismatic English gentleman in things like State of Play. And then like the sort of most commercial version of it is the thing that he does in Love Actually. But with this, it was like, he was so in this part. Yeah. And he was so plausible as this incredibly restrained man who, like, doesn't know how to express the sheer terror that he's found out he's going to die. And, like, I just, you know, he decides to do something with whatever time is left for him. And the other kind of guys around him almost don't realize, like, well, look, we're all dying, like, at the end of the day. Like, we're all, to some extent, in the situation he's in. So it should inspire you to take risks and take chances and do things that you want to do. And he inspires the two younger people in his life. But yeah, I just thought it was beautifully made. Like, the script was great. Ishiguro, just classy, beautifully executed.
Good answer.
What was your greatest film?
My greatest film is Mass, as it was at the beginning of the year. And I think that, it's difficult because all these films are great and amazing. But I do think that Mass is... which I've obviously talked about in this podcast, but not for a year because I've been holding off for this.
Yeah.
Mass is a small film that's an hour and a half that is essentially four people at a table talking. And it is incredibly cinematic for a film that on paper is like a play. And it is about an incredibly difficult... Again, on paper, I go, oh, I didn't want to see Mass. That sounds not fun.
Yeah.
And it isn't fun. It isn't fun, to be fair. But what it is... You know, I've talked about it with you, this idea of hopelessness that I hate in art. If the message of the film is, what's the fucking point?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's fucked. And this film takes an incredibly difficult, difficult subject. And I think it treats it with respect and dignity and thoughtfulness. And it's an incredible piece of writing. The characters are so specific and none of them seem like sort of stereotypes. They're all weird. They're quite weird.
Yeah.
Anne Dowd's character is weird.
Yeah.
And like kind of uncomfortable and you don't sort of warm to her. And yet she's a very tragic character. And yet the end of the film, the sort of point of it is a genuine solution. It isn't just like, well, here's a note of hope to leave you with. Within this heavy, heavy, incredibly sad, difficult subject, here is a thoughtful, actual solution that could lead to a better world. You know what I mean? And it's based on those... I'm so sorry that I don't know the official term for it, but I believe they did it in the basically making victims meet with
perpetrators. The families of the victims and the families of the perpetrators in a mass shooting
to try to find some forgiveness and understanding and hopefully be able to move forward in some way from this very severe grief tragedy. And I think that if the acting's amazing, the directing's amazing, the writing is, I think it's an amazing bit of writing. And it's just phenomenal. That is it.
Yeah. I watched it
because you were so insistent about how much you loved it. And there was a moment, I was really in it and I thought it was brilliant. And there was a moment where I was like, man, I'm genuinely surprised that Brett likes this. Only because one of the things that you really don't like is films that seem like plays. Yeah. Well, sorry. One of the things you don't like is plays, full stop. But like definitely like films that seem theatery. And I did think there was a point, because also it's, I think the way that it's filmed is really interesting because the camera is quite sort of fixed and it doesn't really go handheld for a lot of the beginning of the film. It's often like quite locked off shots. And then suddenly as the kind of, there's like an argument happens and the camera suddenly starts to go handheld. And it's like, it's that same thing where a technical thing has a really emotional and rhythmic impact, because suddenly you like feel it makes your stomach go, like you suddenly feel like, fuck, this thing's unraveling. And as it starts to unravel, the kind of icy technique starts to unravel, and then it suddenly hard cuts to the view outside the church. And I just thought that, and then I was like, oh right, okay, that's why Brett likes it, because actually it's a film and it's filmmaking. And the just because the techniques are subtle and subsumed doesn't mean that they're not there and choices haven't been made. No, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I just thought that like fucking Jason Isaacs' face in that film, like he's just this like contorted ball of like grief and rage. And the four performances are incredible. Like without the four performances are extraordinary. The script is brilliant. I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
I also think the moment at the kind of very near the end, like they seem to have kind of reached a conclusion in their conversation, and the father of the shooter leaves, and they kind of say goodbye to each other, and then the mum and dad comes back to say one more thing, and it's such a sort of heartbreaking thing that she says, and genuinely, what I think is amazing about it is it doesn't let it off the hook. You know what I mean? No. It sort of goes, whatever the solution you now have in your head, this is, there's also this.
Yeah.
And this is fucking difficult for all of them. And I just think it's an incredible piece of empathetic writing that Fran Kranz, who I met and was on the podcast and is like 12 years old, that he could have, got so deep into this in such a way that doesn't feel remotely didactic or preachy or like archetypal. It's like so specific, these characters. And so I just particularly love that Andad and her husband in it, that they're quite odd and uncomfortable. You don't warm to them for a long time. And
well, and also there's lots of unspoken stuff. Like they live separately now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's sort of just that's quite casually thrown away and mentioned.
Yeah.
But obviously it's hugely important because it's happened. This is, I think, we're 6 years after the shooting at the point that this conversation has happened. And, you know, that it's great, just throwaway detail. You know, when in one sentence, someone basically just says a film and then moves on.
Yeah.
You know, like a film about the sort of relationship between two people breaking down because their son killed. I mean, that is literally, that's pretty much, we need to talk about Kevin. Like, we need to talk about Kevin. It's just like quite elegantly said, almost as an aside.
There's also the thing that the beginning of the film that plays into my whole thing of life is sort of mundane, tiny things and huge seismic things. And the kind of, it's funny. It's almost funny, the setup.
It's funny.
Of like, where do we put the seats? What the reality of how are we setting up the room for this thing? And just the mechanics of it. And this woman trying to do the right thing. And it's arguing over whether you put nibbles on a table. Like, it's amazing.
But also those two characters that work at the church are comedy characters. Like, again, completely wrong-footed, knowing the subject matter and going in, you're like, these are like Coen Brothers characters. Like, they're like sort of weird small-town American, like, eccentrics. But you're like, of course they're eccentrics. They're people who, like, regularly volunteer at a church. Like, we know people that volunteer in, like, community theatres and community churches. They can sometimes be a little odd. And they did remind me of, like, the venue stuff in, like, a small art centre, like, charming, eccentric goofballs. And obviously, just because what's about to happen is very heavy. It's still happening in a community hall, in a church hall. So the people running it. But for the first 5 minutes, I was more confused than I've been in a film at any point this year. Because I was literally like, what the fuck is going on? I thought this was like a school shooting drama. And now I'm watching this kind of sitcom episode about that. It was brilliant. It was really, really brilliant.
Good. All right, good. All right, that's that done. Right. Yeah. Oh, here's a good one. What's the funniest film of the year?
Well, why don't you go for this one? Let me tell me what the funniest film of the year is.
I loved Bros. I went to see Bros quite late in the world of Bros. I went with a friend of the podcast, Camille, who was heavily pregnant. We went in an afternoon to watch Bros. And I loved it. I thought it was fucking funny. I think it's a massively underrated film. I completely understand why it was... I think it had excellent reviews and then it didn't do particularly well at the box office and people...
Yeah, were like, right.
There were all these arguments of why that was. I think what it is, it's a lot of films and I like all of them. It's a really fun, traditional rom-com. It's also quite a raunchy gay comedy and like quite hardcore in that side of it. And it is also like a Spike Lee film.
There's
parts in it when they're in that museum where you'll get given flashes of the history where it's like, this is a Spike Lee film. This is also a Spike Lee film. And the other side of it is, it's fucking funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Genuinely made me laugh out loud many times. I think it's an excellent film and deserved more.
Yeah, I thought it was very funny. I definitely agree with you that it felt like a few different movies. And I felt maybe the third one of those, the kind of Spike Lee film, all felt too much like a different film that I would also have liked to see, but I didn't feel got developed
not
enough.
The same
and
time.
Actually, I was perfectly happy watching the straight up rom-com slash the sort of more adult version of a rom-com, like raunchier version of rom-com. I was very happy watching that and didn't necessarily need or would have like been happier watching a separate version of that third film. But it's definitely very funny. Like, it's definitely got really good jokes in it and really funny performers in it.
Yeah. What's your funniest film of the year?
Well, there were lots of comedy movies that I enjoyed. Really liked Funny Pages a lot.
That's great.
Really, massive shout out for Funny Pages because I thought that was a really, like, what a fucking grubby fucking movie.
Yeah, so grubby. Oh, my God. It is full grubby.
There's an old Chris Rock routine about how he finds Jermaine Jackson greasy and he says that he has to wipe his TV down every time Jermaine is on TV. And after Funny Pages, I was like, I've got to give this TV a wipe. Like that, it was it like the flat that he goes, anyway, it's a wonderful movie and I hope people go and watch it. But if I'm being completely honest with you, the film that made me laugh the most this year, just I'm purely doing it in terms of... I thought Knives Out 2 was so funny.
It was really funny.
And I thought it was consistently funny throughout. I think that there are genuinely great jokes in it. I think that Jared Leto's hard kombucha is hilarious. I think that there are like also really fun little meta jokes for film fans, which obviously I love. In one of the flashback sequences, a clue that Edward Norton is the biggest dickhead in the world is that he has come out that night dressed like Tom Cruise's character from Magnolia. And that it's such a brilliant way of going, this guy saw Magnolia and thought Tom Cruise was someone he should dress like. Like, that he's such a fucking bellend and like a misogynist and all of these things. And also, I thought it was a brilliant satire about disruptors and, you know, that we're sort of constantly seeing people describe themselves as disrupting things. And generally what it means is, I don't really pay a full whack of tax. Like, that's genuinely what they do. Like, the main thing that they disrupt is the taxation system and the coffers of the public purse. And I thought that all of that stuff was great. And then I thought it became a kind of satire that became embedded within the mystery. And like Knives Out 1 had lots of satirical elements and it was a kind of goof on satire and privilege, but the mystery of it is still preserved. Like the mystery of it is specific. And what happens to Christopher Plummer is a specific Agatha Christie mystery. In this one, the satire seeps into the mystery. So at the end, there is no mystery. It was the person you thought it was the whole time because disruptors and people that claim to be disruptors are simply not interesting enough. And like, Daniel Craig's exasperated speech at the end, I thought was so funny and like such a perfect like distillation of something in the culture that I was hooting. Like I was properly like lost my mind laughing. I thought it was so funny. And also like at the opposite end, I loved it because it was a film that hated a lot of its characters. Like it loves, obviously it loves Benoit Blanc and it absolutely loves Janelle Monáe. And who was great in it as well. Like that double performance thing is fucking brilliant. I thought she was brilliant in it. It loves Janelle Monáe, but it hates all of its other characters. And lots of the like TV and film that's kind of depicting the super wealthy by necessity in order to sustain the drama, especially if it's a TV show, it has to be nuanced and it has to give you layers to these people. This was fucking 2 hours and it was a comedy movie and they were just like, fuck these people.
But I would say this is my point. Yeah, I think it thinks they're all idiots, but I think it joyfully thinks that it...
I still think
it loves them. I think it is loving hanging out with them and making fun with them.
Yeah, yeah, it's loving hanging out with them, and it's loving... But it is deeply loving giving the consequences to them and giving Janelle Monáe... And, like, you know, she's so... Like, he's like Ana de Armas in the first movie, like, she's such a, like, likeable central presence, and the film clearly loves her and loves Benoit Blanc, but it properly... Like, it made me laugh out loud consistently. And I saw it in, and again, like, just, they should have released it for longer in the cinema because it was a pleasure to see it in a packed cinema, people laughing, people gasping. I thought it was really fucking funny.
Good answer. Do, 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 welcome to the Patreon section. Oh, come on in, Nish. You've been missed. Say hello. Also, tell us a secret. You fucking tell us a fucking secret or we'll kick you out.
I'm trying to think about what a good secret would be this year. I guess, like, it's funny that I... Well, here's a good secret. I attended a screening of Licorice Pizza, a press screening of Licorice Pizza, with a Q&A with Alana Haim and Paul Thomas Anderson. And when they asked me whether my name was on the list, I said yes. They said, what's your name? I said, Brett Goldstein. And I walked in because it was your ticket. You were away for the Q&A. True. And you were like, just take my ticket. And I just assumed there'd be a ticket. There wasn't. There was a guest list. I looked a man in the eye and said, my name is Brett Goldstein. I would like to see Licorice Pizza, please.
And they let you in, right? Because I'm big in the UK. I'm big.
I was wearing my AFC Richmond top. And I did go up to them and went, oh, let me in, you fucking cunts. Kayleigh. I made James Acaster come along dressed as Keeley.
I love that. All right, that's a good
No, I'll be honest with you. They knew I wasn't Brett Goldstein. They might have even known who me and James Acaster were. They just couldn't be bothered. Just they had a lot on. It was a busy screen.
What's he going to do here?
It was a busy screening.
What's the film that changed your perspective on something this year, Nish Kumar?
Okay, I definitely, I'm very happy to talk about this film because I really liked it. And I think it sort of changed my perspective on a few things. Benediction, which is Terence Davis's film about the war poet Siegfried Sassoon. And it's like another one of those movies where like what I associate those war poets with, unfortunately, is being forced to read them at school. And I thought that this would be a boring film, and I wasn't particularly interested in seeing it. But then I think I might have seen the trailer and thought, oh, well, actually, that looks interesting. And also, everything Terence Davis does is interesting. Like, whether, you know, whether it's successful or not, everything is interesting, you know? Whether it's like, I mean, Distant Voices, Still Lives is fucking incredible, but, like, he is one of the great British filmmakers. And I went to see it, and I loved it so much. It's absolutely one of the best films I saw this year. And I think that it made me think a lot of things. I talk about it quite a lot in therapy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because I just think that generation, particularly of gay men, were put through so much trauma. They had to live these like secret lives. They all end up getting into these unhappy marriages to equally unhappy women, and both of their lives get ruined. And the trauma warps them. And I think one of the things that you understand as you get older is like, I think when you're a kid, you're like, well, you hit 21 and then you're sort of the same person until you're about 30, and then you're just that person until you die. And people talk a lot about self-improvement, but also the opposite is true. You can get worse as a person. And Benediction is the story of Siegfried Sassoon's personality being bent out of shape by his life experience and his trauma. Like, and he sees terrible things in the First World War. But then he has to, like, he comes back and there's no, like, hero worship because he has to live a lie for his entire life. And then also he's in love with Wilfred Owen. Wilfred Owen is killed. And then it's almost beyond that. And maybe this is something that I just thought, like, if you produce cultural work on art of any description, there's like a pettiness to him about how he's received critically that I also really related to, that I thought. But all of that, like, warps him and makes him really sad. And I thought it was a really brilliant depiction. Like, the transition from Jack Loudon, who plays him as a younger man, to Peter Capaldi, I think is so wonderfully done. And also there's just lots of, like, funny and sort of joyful scenes when he's, like, in his 20s and early 30s. And he's just, there's this whole, like, secret subculture of gay men who live these kind of lives, and they have the, you know, they sleep with each other, and they, you know, go to these fabulous cocktail parties, and then they all sort of have to sadly go off and get married. And also I did think, so it made me think differently about how tragedy and trauma can warp you as a person and your life experience. You don't just live through things, like, life has an impact on you. And if you don't take care to maintain your personality, it can collapse without you even realizing that. He doesn't realize how bitter he's become by the end of his life. And his son is just like, you know, why are you so angry about all of these things? And there's a point where it's like, why are you angry with new things? He's like, because it's young. And it's the most honest thing he says. Like, he's bitter that his youth has kind of disappeared. But also, it really made me, and this is the sort of anger you can only have if you're not from a marginalized community and are having it semi-patronizingly on their behalf. But, like, we studied so much Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon when I was at school. And at no point did it ever come up that they were gay. At no point. And just, you think about, like, it isn't just that, it's an active suppression of information, you know? Like, we were still at school when Section 28 was a law. And, like, it was, you know, there was a law on the statute books to prevent the promotion of homosexuality, or whatever they called it. And it's just like, you know, these people who we, like, force you to study, they were gay men. And, like, Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon are huge parts of the national story we tell ourselves about the sacrifice at war. We're not even going to fucking give them the dignity of telling you that they were gay. And we're going to continue to suppress their sexuality as we did to them when they were alive after they're dead. And you sort, I sort of walked out of it being like, it's so wrong. Like, it's, you know, like, obviously a gay person knows all of this stuff and is like, yeah, we've been angry about this for a long, long time. And, but I walked out of it thinking how different a country we'd be if these people who were, like, we venerate as, like, titans of the story we tell ourselves about the sacrifice of our boys. And we say things like, never forget, you must never forget, but forget this bit.
That also,
forget this huge fucking part of their lives and personality.
But do ignore.
That's that, actually. You know what, Brett? That's the perfect description of the British attitude to history. Never forget, but do ignore. Do ignore.
Do ignore.
Please do ignore. Please details. I hope it's on Netflix in the UK at the moment. I don't know if it's globally available, but Benediction is on Netflix in the UK. And I think it's a brilliant, brilliant film. And we're just very lucky to have a filmmaker like Terence Stovers.
And Jack Loudon is a brilliant actor. Oh. I loved him ever since Fighting With My Family. He's brilliant. Yeah. All right. My answer to this question is, good luck to you, Leo Grande.
Lovely.
Or Leo Grande.
Leo Grande.
Good luck to Leo Grande, which I just really liked. I liked as a script, as performance, as an argument. I just liked it. That's another film. That's two films that on paper could be like plays.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're films. And I thought, what did it change my perspective on? I'm not sure it entirely changed the perspective, but it did. I liked the, I don't know, it just showed you something that you don't usually see, which was an older woman with a sex worker trying to experience something, and it felt very real, the nervousness of her and the insecurity. And I thought it was a sort of wonderful thing that he never makes her come. She does it herself. And it's like, it's a nice thing.
It definitely shows you something you don't really see on TV anymore, you know, from that age expressing her sexuality and it not being like, it's not like a totally...
Maureen, what's this I hear about you going to film school? I am. I want to gain valuable skills while making films and developing my creativity. So I'm attending the New York Film Academy. I'm thinking about becoming one of them people that writes the numbers on the title board. NYFA is a very respected film school. I hear they offer a variety of options to meet your educational goals, whether you want a BFA or MFA degree, or want to learn at a quicker pace with a short-term program. That's right! They've got workshops and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, cinematography, screenwriting, producing, game design, musical theatre, and more. Are you attending in New York? Might do. They have multiple campuses in some amazing locations like New York, LA, Miami, Italy, Australia, and online. And you can learn more about the New York Film Academy at nyfa.edu. That's nyfa.edu. Thanks, Maureen.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Serious movie, like it's funny in places, but it's not like that element of it and her sexuality is not like played for jokes.
No. The only bit that I was like, that, the only bit in the whole film that I was like, that's mad, is when she disappears for a moment and he eats a Kit Kat. he just stuffs a Kit Kat in and then goes to kiss her. I'm like, that's... You've lost me. I'd have got rid of you immediately.
It's chewing gum or nothing.
What is the best opening to a film, 2022?
Straight up, Woman King. I thought the opening of the Woman King was incredible. Right. That attack scene. And again, it... you know, you get the information about what you need to know about the Oyo and the Dahomey, and then you just immediately, bang, you're into it. The shot of Viola Davis standing up from the kind of long grass and then the shot of them all joining her and then just straight into that fight scene. I thought it was, like, I was giddy at the beginning. You know, the, like, when a film really starts fast, the sort of adrenal rush of it just going, it captured that thrill of, like, how exciting it is when a film just goes, here's absolutely minimal exposition. I mean, it's an odd comparison to make, but it sort of is the Star Wars thing. You get the crawl and then bang, straight into the action. Yeah. I thought it was great. What was yours?
I think I'll go with, I had a few, but I think I'll go with Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio.
Oh, lovely.
Which, I love that film. It's such a dark film, such a weird film, moving, and a film entirely about death, which, you know, I'm all
about.
Yeah,
perfect. And on the theme for the podcast as well.
And the fact there's kind of a, you know, prologue, which is the beginning, and it's fucking heavy.
Yeah.
It's really, really heavy. And I'm big into stop motion and it's just beautiful. And the dad, the performance and the animation of the dad in that film should have won an Oscar for best actor. It's just such a good, and also when you think about the magic of it, it's the magic of the actor's voice, but in conjunction with the artists who have made that puppet moving that way. It's such a detailed face he has and the micro expressions and all of it. It's just really something special, that.
Oh, that's great.
So I'll give it to Pinocchio.
Right.
What is the greatest ending to a film this year? Final sequence or scene? Well,
definitely special mention for the end of Triangle of Sadness, a movie which I will mention.
Great ending.
I have for one of the other answers. But, like, I've never been in a cinema before where the entire audience is thinking, smash that woman over the head with a rock. When she basically says to her, don't worry, we could go back to civilization and you can be my, like, helper or maid or something. And she realizes that actually it's better for her to be in the community they've created because she's at the top of the hierarchy. And the entire audience is like, yeah, you have to bash him on the... You absolutely have... There's no other way for it. But I'm going to say the best closing was Hit the Road, which I also thought was an amazing movie. And it's like, it sort of summarizes everything that is amazing about that film. Because, you know, it sort of is a heavy film. Like, it's a movie about a family who have hit the road because they're basically, their son is in trouble with the Iranian authorities and he's basically fleeing the country. But there's a little kid in the car. And so the whole film is kind of the little kid's perspective. And it's mainly the little kid being a little kid and talking about the Batmobile and stuff. And sort of on the peripheries, you go, oh, there's something quite serious and bad happening here. But mainly it's like funny dialogue between the dad and the kid. And the mum is occasionally looking worried at the older son, who's the person that that's fleeing. And it's like mainly like very naturalistic. You're in the car, you feel immersed in it. And then there's one moment where this kind of special effect thing happens when the dad and the son are talking and they're like lying and looking up at the stars because they've set up camp on their journey. And it almost becomes like this weird, like 1960s Doctor Who shot of like space and the kid flying. And then the second flourish is the end because the son has got away for all the like fun and joy of it. It's very traumatic and it's very upsetting. And then their dog dies and they're burying the dog. And it's just this fucking bleak thing. And then just like right at the end, throughout, there's been like these like Iranian pop songs running through the whole thing. And then just right at the end, the kid lip syncs the song right down the barrel of the camera, like this little kid. And it's I apologize, I'm about to absolutely mangle the pronunciation of all of this, I'm sure, but the song is called Sabzede by a guy called Ebi, and I definitely have pronounced that incorrectly, but it's this like really like croonery rich melodic pop song, and the kid starts lip syncing it looking down the barrel of the camera, and it's such a like funny and surprising and like charming end to this movie. And it's like, you know, that you sort of come away from it with the sense of like they still got each other and they might be okay. And the way that that's communicated is the kid singing down the barrel of the camera. It just like it just made me feel elated at the end of that movie. I think the movie is great in general, but yeah, that ending made me feel elated.
That is great. My answer to best ending, I mean, loads of them. But I'm going to pick, because I haven't mentioned this film, and it was one of my films of the year, Watcher.
Watcher. Yes.
Did you see Watcher?
I didn't see Watcher. I would have liked to see Watcher.
Watcher deserved more, as in, I went to see it at the cinema, and I was like, God, it's nice to see a film like this at the cinema. It's, I guess, you know, a B-movie made exceptionally well.
Right, yeah.
And it's about a woman in, and it's so good. It's one of the best depictions of being a foreigner in a country. Mm-hmm. Like, just there's scenes where she's just walking around not understanding the language and like going to museums and trying to kind of enjoy her life, but the whole time she can't understand what anyone's saying. And so there's this sense of paranoia. Are they talking about her? Are they?
Yeah,
but they might not be. She just genuinely doesn't understand what anyone's saying. And so there's a scene with her and her husband in the back of a cab at the beginning of the film. And the husband, they're clearly talking about her, but she doesn't know what they're saying. And the husband keeps sort of translating, but there's an element, there's one thing the husband doesn't translate.
Right.
So it's like, what did he just say?
Right, you know
what I mean?
Right,
it's really sort of good. And she believes she is being watched by someone in the apartment opposite.
Right.
And that she is kind of being stalked. But as it goes on, he, the person watching, goes to the police and accuses her of stalking him because she's so obsessed that it looks like actually she's watching him.
Yeah, right.
And anyway, I won't spoil the ending, but something happens at the ending and it is literally, there is a look at the very end of the film and the look is, it's just one look and the look is sort of, I won't even say what it means, but it's fucking like, kablowy at the end. It's a very good film. Recommend.
I've got to check it out.
Really good. Best set piece. Favourite set piece of the year, of any film? It could be the middle of any film.
Well, I definitely think the entire city freezing in Worst Person in the World was incredible.
Yeah.
But I am going to say just everybody spewing. Triangle of Sadness. Everybody spewing.
Mm.
That Refuse song from The Shape of Punk to Come, which weirdly also was like all over The Bear. Like, it's so strange when like a song that came out ages ago, suddenly two people both decide to use it in quite pivotal ways in a TV show or a film. That song, that fucking that sort of like hooky guitar thing, and then just everybody puking and shitting. And I am embarrassed by how much that woman vomiting into the toilet and then the boat tilting and her being led away and going, oh God, made me scream with laughter. Phenomenal. What's yours?
Mine is, I picked this also because it wasn't talked about Cyrano. Cyrano, which is how they pronounce it in the film.
Cyrano.
The Peter Dinklage, Joe Wright, Cyrano, yeah. Which I wasn't sure about seeing. I ended up watching it on a plane. And it's a musical. It's a musical adaptation of Cyrano.
Yeah.
And he's phenomenal in
it. Right, yeah.
It's really like, oh, this was the part. This is the part. This is the greatest part for you ever.
Right, yeah.
He's really, really, really good. And it's quite sort of theatrical and weird. And I'm not saying it's perfect. Like it's certainly an acquired taste, I would say. Yeah. But it was certainly mine. I really enjoyed it. And there's a sequence about three quarters of the way through where a load of characters you have never met and are not part of your leads sing a song
right.
as they're about to go to war. They're basically about to go over the top to their deaths in the war.
Yeah.
They're being sent to like go over the top and it's very clear they're all going to die. And they sing this song, Wherever I Fall. And they're basically writing letters, their final letters home to their wives and fathers. And it's so good. It's really, really beautiful. And I listened to a thing with Joe Wright where the producers or the financiers, whoever it was, were like, you need to cut that scene because it's not about the lead characters. And so he very deliberately, at the end of this song, the camera pulls back and there's Cyrano. So he's in it. He's in it, so you can't cut it. But it's just a really, it's just one of them really like powerful moments of this is the end of all these people's lives. And you totally care about them. You've never met them and you, of course, you care about them. It's really, it's good. Good stuff.
Yeah. Just to briefly mention it, because we haven't really talked about it, All Quiet on the Western Front has like kind of all like a version of that in the scene. And it's, there's just a really...
But not sung.
Not sung. Not sung. It would have been a quite extraordinary decision. But yeah, there's a really good scene where you just see people like, you're just seeing people like hops up on nationalism. Like it's almost like it's depicted like a drug that they're all on. And they're just like, I can't wait to get to war. Like, and then it's basically just for 3 hours ruining their sense that they're doing something good. It's a very well-made film. But yeah, it's funny because it has the exact same sentiment, just not sung.
If I've got any notes, can I sing this? What is your... Here we go. I think we're here. What was your favourite film of the year?
I could not split After Sun and Everything Everywhere. We tallied the votes.
Well, why don't you take After Sun and I'll take Everything Everywhere all the
way. Okay, great. Perfect. Is that what you were going to say anyway? Were you also in the similar quandary?
Yeah. But I think I was leaning Everything Everywhere purely because of the amount of things it is in one film. And all of those things are amazing.
Yeah.
And I think it deserves extra. And it's fun.
Do you think that there might have been... There has been a little bit of a backlash against it. Do you think if it hadn't won the Oscars, it would have... In a way, it would be better for the immediate reputation of the movie?
I haven't seen this backlash, but I'm assuming, that would... The worst thing that could happen to a film is to win Best Picture.
you're absolutely right. Like, I would say apart from Moonlight and Parasite, I'm not sure there's a film that I can remember that it hasn't in the short term damaged its prospect. But yeah, listen, After Sun, Everything Everywhere. Couldn't choose between them. I'll go After Sun, you go Everything Everywhere.
Right. We conclude with... Top 10 in order.
Do you want to do the honourable mentions first?
Well, I've realised we have mentioned all of the honourable mentions that I had. Did we mention all of yours? Oh, no, you had extras.
Only honourable mentions I would say, I thought The Quiet Girl was brilliant and I thought it would be boring. But actually, it was really brilliant. I thought it was really good. I loved Moon Edge Daydream. I'm a big Bowie fan, like Brett Morgan. The sort of sound collage and the use of video in it is really, really incredible. Like, I would go as far as saying, even if you're not a Bowie fan, it's worth seeing, just a piece of filmmaking. And also, like, a quick honourable mention for Kimmy, which is, like, not really a movie that gets made. Like, it felt like a, like, 90s... like really entertaining, fast-paced, paranoid tech thriller. Like, and Zoe Kravitz was great in it. And like Steve Soderbergh, like, is another one of those like George Miller characters where you're like, you can't really pin down what he's going to do next. And what he did next was Magic Mike 3. Like, it's like, and the next movie he does might be like an experimental digital film after he's like shoved an iPhone up a dog's ass or something. Like, it's like, you really just, you have no idea what he's going to do. Kimmy, Dogtown. Magic Mike 3, and Dogtown, up a dog's ass. There's an iPhone up a dog's ass. Julia Roberts is in it, you just can't see her.
We shot this one up a dog's ass, one take.
It was while I was making Magic Mike 3. Just in the background, I just had a dog with an iPhone up its ass.
Okay, your top 10 in order, please.
My top 10 in order. I'm just making sure that there's not more than 10 here. Okay, my top 10 in order is Hit the Road, Living, mm-hmm. Parallel Mothers, which we didn't talk about at all. Pedro.
No. Pedro, he's back.
He's
maybe.
Never went away. And he's like films.
He's always
he's
here.
Funny because his films are like getting like sadder, but also still out as outrageous. Like this is still like a sort of soap opera. It's just it also has really serious things to say about the Spanish Civil War and the legacy of fascism. Like he's the best, man. Souvenir Part 2, Decision to Leave, Benediction, The Worst Person in the World, Everything Everywhere, After Sun.
Okay.
Give me your 10.
Watcher at 10.
Nice.
At 9. Good Luck to Leo Grande. Oh,
lovely.
8. Top Gun Maverick. 7. Bros. 6. Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio. 5. Worst Person in the World. 4. Banshees of Inisherin. 3. After Sun. 2. Mass 1. Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Fantastic.
God, well, that's hard though, isn't it? Is that right? Or do I have to think Mass is it there? I mean, favourites and greatest, all right? We get it.
Yeah, I sort of can't believe that I haven't got Knives Out 2 in there because I've really loved it.
Yeah, that's insane.
There's no way that I'm going to feel the same about this tomorrow.
You know what else we've missed out?
What?
Brian and Charles.
Oh, yeah.
I'll say briefly this. Brian and Charles is a wonderful film. Brian Gittins, I worked with Brian for many, many years. I love Brian. I was so happy. I'm proud that Brian Gittins has existed in so many different forms, all of which have been amazing, none of which have been particularly successful. And so for him to have found this thing where it was like this film and suddenly it was like a hit, a critical hit and an awards hit. And it was like, you've fucking done it. I love it.
Yeah, it's great. That could also have been like one of the meaningful experiences because my friend Jim Archer was also directed it. And it's fucking great. It's wonderful.
Nish,
Brett.
You've been wonderful. But when you tried to compliment me on another Emmy and I murdered you with the Emmy, I beat you to death with it. And I'll be honest, didn't take as long as you might think. It's one of the spikes straight through your eye into your brain.
Done. Dead.
I almost didn't even use the base of it at all. It was mostly top half of Emmy. Stab, stab, eyes, took out your eyes, through the brain. And then just bashed it in
100%.
Until you were dead.
Yeah.
And that's the last time you'll pay me a compliment, son. And but then I find you because I just killed you.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, bloody hell, what a mess. So I put you in a coffin. I've got a coffin. Put you in all the stuff. It's full in there. There's only enough room for you to take one film of the year with you to take to movie night when it is your movie night in heaven. What film are you taking to show people of heaven in movie night when it's your turn? Mr. Nish Kumar.
Well, I think Everything Everywhere, After Sun, people will bring them. So I'm going to bring Benediction.
You are such a bummer. You bring such a downer. Fucking hell. All the people in heaven. Welcome, Nish. What are we watching? The saddest film of the year. Oh, thanks, mate. Can we send him back again? We keep sending him back. Yeah, but he's such a Debbie Downer.
Take your medicine, heaven. Take your medicine.
Well done, Nish.
Well done to you, Brett. Time. Another great year.
We did it in only 2 hours and a half. We really did it this time.
That'll get... Listen, the important thing is we're keeping it down to a two-parter.
Yes, it's another two-part classic. Nish, I hope I see you very soon. And I've realised we've never done your Judgment Day, have we?
No.
I've just sort of killed and resurrected, never judged you. Maybe it's time we did one day, we'll see.
Well, I'll tell you what else, Brett. I've seen some films in 2023. I've seen some films, let me tell you.
I've seen some films. And I'll tell you, here's my review so far of the year 2023. The mainstream is doing good shit.
Good shit, man.
There's good some shit out the mainstream.
Good shit coming. Like,
some good main Hollywood films.
Yeah.
Like, oh, someone's remembered how to make good films.
Yeah.
Here we go.
And people are going to see them as well, which is fucking great. It's really exciting. And like, let's not...
Anyway, let's wait till June next year. All right. Well done. Oh, yeah. When do we listen to Toilet Dish on the Pod?
Toilet Dish on the Pod starts on May the 4th. It's called Pod Save the UK, regrettably. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you. I'll see you soon.
Peace out.
So that was episode 244. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for all the extra videos, chat and stuff and secrets with Nish. Remember to watch Shrinking and Ted Lasso on Apple TV+. Also, this week is my final week with Acast. I'm moving to iHeartRadio next week. Nothing will change in the service here. I want to say thank you to Acast, who've been absolutely brilliant. They've been here from the beginning and they've been wonderfully supportive and wonderful. And I love everyone there and I will miss them. Thank you very much for everything. Thank you to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Acast for hosting this for so long. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come and join me next week for a brand new episode with a you know, an absolutely banging guest. So that is it for now. Thank you very much for listening. And in the meantime, have a good week. And please, be excellent to each other. Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.